I want to ask you a serious question. Do you feel a little stuck in your two-person scenes? Do you feel like you're doing the same scenes over and over again, like every scene you do is about a roommate? Well, if you answer yes, then I want to help. And the best way I know how to help you is by letting you know that I will be teaching my two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop on Saturday, December 30th, here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people, so you get personal attention. To register or for more information, just go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're a seasoned improviser, an actor, or new to improv, I just want to let you know I'll be starting my next Artist Low Comedy Level 1 class on January 10th at Green Shirt Studios here in Chicago. I also limit this to 10 people, so you get personal attention. And to register or for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com.
Feral Audio.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Mark Sutton. Mark Sutton is an original member of the Annoyance Theater back in the late 80s, early 90s, where he was part of the cast of Coed Prison Sluts, which is a legendary show in the Annoyance Theater's history. And that's where I first met him back in the late 80s and early 90s when I was part of that theater. Mark has also toured around the country at theaters and festivals with Joe Bill doing their show, Bass Prop. He has taught at the Second City here in Chicago. He's also directed touring companies at the Second City in Chicago. And currently, he is the Artistic Director of Learning and Development for Second City Works, which is Second City's division of teaching workshops to corporate America. We talked to Mark about so many things. We talked to him. We went back to that time in the late 80s and early 90s when Coed Prison Sluts and how they developed that show, which is very fascinating. Even I understudied that show, and I didn't understand some of this stuff until now. We talked about the theater got very popular very quickly. We talked about that. We talked about some things he might do differently if he had the chance. We then talked to him about the Annoyance style of improv and what that means to him. We hear a lot about you got to take care of yourself, hold on to your shit. He explains it, his take on it. Also, what he teaches his students about being vulnerable and how the first 15 seconds of an improv scene, how you get all the information you need right there, and how you can make an emotional connection with your partner and how he thinks that's one of the most important things about improvising. You're going to love this episode, and you're not even going to mind it, I hope, and I'm sneaking this in on you, that the last 10 minutes, because the microphone screwed up, We lost the last 10 minutes of it. We didn't really lose it. We did get it, but you just can't hear it. And I take full responsibility for that. And so when you listen to the episode, Mark gives an example. I ask him a question about denial in improv, and we go into a little example about that, and about two-thirds into it, maybe halfway into the example we're improvising, it ends. So just be aware of that. But enough about that. Really quickly, before we get to the episode, it's great to be back. I've missed you guys. The last couple months or so, I've been burnt out on doing this podcast. I just want to say that I've got some new episodes coming up, so look for those. Hopefully they'll be on a more frequent basis, but I hit a wall, and I just wasn't going to do it if I wasn't going to enjoy it anymore. Because, there's no point to it. So thank you for your patience, and thank you for listening to the older episodes and still contacting me and making me feel that I'm still relevant in improv. So here it is. Enough about me. The Mark Sutton interview. I was almost going to say Mark Howard Sutton, and this is a little in the little background. Back then in the 80s, early 90s, we called him Mark Howard Sutton, and I believe the Howard was he talks about it in this interview. He doesn't explain this part, but he does mention that he wanted to go into broadcasting, sports broadcasting, and I think that might have been the Howard part, might have been Howard Cosell, Howard being Howard Cosell was a pretty famous sports caster, and maybe that's how he got the Mark Howard Sutton. When we interview him for the last 10 minutes, because I'll make it, I would like to do the last 10 minutes, I'll ask him that question. Okay, enough about me. You're going to enjoy this one, the Mark Sutton episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Mark Sutton, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Okay. We go back a long way, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah.
From the early 90s at the Annoyance Theater. But before that, you went to Indiana University, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, you majored in broadcast journalism, hoping to do baseball play-by-play. And then a guy named Mick Napier recruits you for his comedy group, where you first get exposed to improv. And what was that like?
It was kind of crazy, you know, because Mick and I had been friends, and I knew him because we lived in the same dorm. So my sophomore year was his freshman year, and that's where we met in college. And then I would, me and some other guys that knew him would go to see his plays because he was a regular actor in the IU theater program. And it was the IU theater program is pretty good. And so he was studying acting. He would do shows. We'd go to see the shows. We'd go to theater parties, that whole thing. But then around junior year, something like that, his junior year, he saw a Second City show and decided that he wanted to start a comedy group. So he did. And I wasn't in the original group, but I would go see the shows because we were roommates by that time. And
you had no interest in this?
Not really. Okay. You know, I mean, I had always been interested in comedy, but never saw myself as a performer. And then one time, late in the spring, his group had a show. They had a regular show off campus. And several members of the group had been cast in a play. So the only three people that were left to do the show were Mick, Faith Soloway, and Eric Waddell. And like, we need somebody else. We don't want to do a three-person show. So they recruited me to kind of like pinch hit for that show and learned a few sketches, did a couple things. And then by the next year, I was a regular part of the group.
How were you when you first started out? Because you guys had no, like there was no formal training. I think Dave McNerland had, mm-hmm, read Something Wonderful right away.
And Mick, yeah.
And Joe Bill knew a little short form.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we just made up games. Like, we made up our own games. And based on some of the games that Mick had seen or whatever. And we were stupid enough to think that we could write an original sketch comedy show every week while we're going to college. So we would have rehearsal at like 1 a.m. and we'd rehearse from 1 to 3 and we'd work on sketches, and it was all kind of like slapdash, but it was such a great learn by doing, you know? And so then when we progressed in our lives and we get to Chicago and you're in those situations where it's like, oh, we still need a sketch for the show tomorrow or whatever, you know, we're all like, yeah, that's easy, because we had done that all the time.
So Mick and Joe Bill and Faith Soloway and, mm-hmm, Eric Waddell and Dave McTurk, they all come to Chicago, but you don't come to Chicago originally. How do they talk you into coming to Chicago?
Well, I was still in Indiana. I was in a small town. I went back to my hometown, but I was working at a small radio station, WIOU, Kokomo, Indiana. And
What was the format?
It was just like, you know, top 40. Uh-huh. It was AM radio.
Were you doing sports?
No, I was doing news.
Okay.
So I was the guy who got up at 4:30 in the morning. I was on the air at 5:00 doing the news every half hour. And then I was also a reporter. So
what did that pay back then?
Oh, God. I can't even imagine.
But you were
nothing.
Like living with your parents?
Oh, yeah.
Thing? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still living at home and doing the news. And after several months of that, it was just like, man, this is brutal, you know? And then I started getting the phone calls of like, hey, we're getting the band back together. And that was about the time that a lot of them had taken class at I.O. and they were deciding to kind of break off on their own and start what would become the Annoyance.
Because then they had Metroform.
It was originally
called
Metroform.
You joined them after Metroform, right?
Yeah, the first, they did kind of like an improv show that was Mick, Joe, Dave Rozowski, Richard Label, Ellen Stone King. They did an improv show at Cabaret Metro. There's another space in there, which is why they were called Metroform. And then they decided to do Splatter. So
Splatter Theater, which you know is this bloody gore. Then they keep running, and it's like what 30 years old.
Yeah. So when I moved to Chicago, that was the first year they did Splatter. So I moved here, and the show was already cast, so I was just helping. I would help do the blood effects. I was the dog wrangler. I took care of Kahlua backstage, and I fell out of a closet. That was my first part, is at the end of the show, there's that classic horror scene where the heroine opens the closet, and dead bodies just keep falling out. And we thought it would be funny if a dead body fell out that nobody had ever seen before, and that was me. So I just bloodied myself up and fell out of the closet.
And when you say bloody yourself up, just so people know, it was basically chocolate syrup and red.
Different kinds of red food coloring.
Because we had a group called the Third Rail, because that was up a very small place in Cross Currents. Mm-hmm. And it was a white stage, and you would go there, and there was still, it was really sticky, and there was still like residue left from the blood.
And I remember when we moved out of that space, we talked to the people that tore that stage out, and they said there were just huge sticky piles of blood just stuck to the floor.
That you probably just drained through the cracks.
Yeah.
So that space is where I originally saw co-ed prison sluts. Mm-hmm. And as legend goes about co-ed prison sluts is you either previewed it or the night before it sucked. It didn't get laughs or anything like that. And then you guys pulled an all-nighter. Can you tell us that story? Can you tell us about that?
So we created the show, and it was kind of like last ditch. We were in a bunch of debt as a loosely formed company.
Already.
Yeah, already. Yeah. It was like, if this show doesn't make it, we're kind of done. It's over. And so we came up with this show. We improvised it. It was partly improvised, partly kind of loosely scripted music. And we're all ready to go, and we previewed it on a Wednesday night. It was supposed to open on Thursday, because when it first ran, it ran Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So we previewed on Wednesday night, and I mean like that, like nothing.
No response.
And everybody's just so bummed. Everybody's, you know, we get drunk that night. The next day around, I don't know, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, Mick and I meet at, I don't even know what it's called, right? It's right across the street from Ann Sather's and Comedy Sports. There was a diner on the corner, and it used to be like the other Melrose diner.
Right, yes, I remember that, yeah.
And we sat down, and we're like, okay, we've got today to fix this.
And so if people don't know about Co-ed Prison Sluts, just tell them it's a musical. Mm-hmm. People set in prison. Mm-hmm. There's a
It's a lighthearted. It was a lighthearted musical comedy romp. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of in the tone of those old timey musicals. But it was set in a co-ed prison, and it was graphically profane and a lot of adult subject matter.
Like Slick was the child molester.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sang a song about it.
Right,
and everybody laughed.
Right,
and yeah, so. We sat down and tried to figure out why it wasn't working. And Mick and I just kind of rewrote little parts of it and changed some things around and realized something that, you know, I learned from him that has kind of been a hallmark of his teaching, and that is that we knew that things in the show were funny, but we hadn't let the audience know why they were funny. We hadn't let the audience in on it. And so we had to make some adjustments to different moments in the scene to allow the audience to laugh at what we were doing.
Can you give us an example?
Mm-hmm. So there's a character in the show that Ellen played brilliantly called the Dame. And the Dame was delusional. She's a delusional actress, and she's in prison, and nobody knows why. And she won't let go of the character. She just always behaves like everything in the show that's happening to her is a play. And so when she first did it, nobody laughed at her because they couldn't figure her out. And so we simply, in her introduction, add one exposure line of, you know, that's the Dame. She thinks she's in some sort of a play or something. She's a little weird or whatever the line was. And once we said that line out loud, everybody's like, oh, I get it. This is not really happening like this. She's just a little bit crazy. Then everything she did became funny.
You said something, and I think it was in Pam Victor's interview with you, and that was something like protecting the audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that term is thrown around a lot. What does that mean in terms of the context of co-ed prison sluts?
Well, you know, we had to, at the time, you know, that show was pretty edgy.
Right. And we're talking about 90...
Opened in 89.
89,
yeah.
Okay.
And we had to make it okay for the audience to laugh, and we wanted to push the envelope, but you never want to push it so far that the audience gets turned off. You want them to be with you. So we learned a lot in that show about how do we create material that has an edge to it, that has a point of view, that has a little bit of subversive nature, but also is okay for the audience to sit there and laugh at. Because if you asked anybody when they walked into that show, you're going to hear a song, a bluesy number about, you know, molesting children,
right,
sung by this guy, and you're going to laugh, people would be like, you're out of your mind. I'm never going to laugh at that. But the show presents it in such a way that it makes it okay to laugh at.
What was it that protected that song?
Well, I think that the thing that protected Slick's character and that song was the Skeeter character that I played.
Mm-hmm.
Because Skeeter was a kid, mm-hmm, and he's in prison by mistake, and Slick is always after him, but he never gets him.
Right.
And Skeeter is not a victim. He's probably the smartest one in the room, but he's the youngest one in the room. So that balance of power, mm-hmm, and the fact that Slick talks a big game but never gets what he wants protects that character.
And also, if you think about it, the character that you played, Skeeter, he was naive. There was, mm-hmm, a naiveness to it. So, mm-hmm, it kind of took some of the danger out of it.
Exactly.
Which,
exactly,
is interesting.
It was never menacing.
Right. Because I was Hamster Man,
yes,
after Tom Rosin, the original Hamster Man, for probably a year and a half. And I didn't figure this out until we're discussing it right now. But it's interesting how comedy has changed since 89. Could prison sluts play today?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think that, I mean, they brought it back a couple times, and I did it a couple times, but it's different. You know, you have to be even more conscious of that dynamic. And I know that I had a conversation with one of the actors in it, because when they came back, one of the actors playing Dr. Bello, who Dr. Bello likes to dress up in women's clothes,
right,
chose to play Dr. Bello as more of somebody who wanted to be a woman, mm-hmm, right? And they changed the motivation of the character a little bit, maybe in kind of broadening the scope of the times. But in the context of that show, it's not quite that, right? It's just Dr. Bello never expresses in the show that he wants to become a woman necessarily. He just likes dressing up like a woman, a different mindset or pathology or whatever. So there's little parts of that I don't know. I don't know if it could play now, but I know that we're very much more careful about stuff like that.
So let's go back to back in those times, 89, 90. I mean, the theater takes off really, really super, mm-hmm, quickly. And you know, certainly co-ed prison sluts, and there was other shows like Your Butt and Man to the Musical. And it's the real-life Brady Bunch that puts it on the map. And when I asked you a pre-show question, you had said to me that, and as you reflect on over 25 years ago, that you would do things differently,
mm-hmm,
going back. What are some of the things that you felt, you know what, if I could go back there at that time, a time machine,
yeah,
what would you do differently?
Well, you know, you being part of that community back then,
yeah,
there was a lot of tribalism back,
oh, yeah,
then.
Yes.
And I think that it was cool that everybody was so proud of their theaters,
mm-hmm,
but it also, I think, stopped us from creating some really cool stuff. And there were a few exceptions like Jazz Freddy,
right,
that brought people from different schools of thought and different theaters together for shows. But there was a lot of like, are you an Annoyance guy? Are you an IO guy? Are you a Second City guy? That kind of stuff. And I think it kept a lot of connections from being made to a certain degree. But with that show especially, you know, Brady Bunch kind of came out of nowhere. It got hugely popular, and then it left, and it went to New York. And we had always been sort of that family, right? We were kind of our own little tribe of people, and that show kind of split the tribe. And there was a lot of bad feelings about that. And there was a lot of feelings that I harbored of, you know, you guys are deserting us. You know, you're chasing money to go to New York and things like that. And I remember being in a meeting where, you know, part of it was pragmatism, part of it was anger. I you know, there was an article written about us in Chicago Magazine at the time, and I was described by the writer of that article in my role as annoyance as the keeper of the grudges. And I think that's true. I was angry at those people in a lot of ways. And we had a meeting where people would be like, well, you know, until these people come back from New York and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we'll do this until they come back and all this stuff. And I said in the meeting, I remember saying, they're never coming back. Those people are never coming back.
Could some of the anger, and you know, if you're on this podcast, it can go into therapy.
Yeah.
Could some of the anger have been towards yourself because you had the opportunity to go to New York? Because you were the original Mr. Brady, right?
Second. Richard Label did it for two episodes.
Right.
And then I did it. But I did it for the better part of the run.
Right. And you were offered to go to New York.
Yep. Yep. And chose not to. And
how do you look at that decision today? Because you're smiling as I say.
Well, I don't regret it. And I don't regret that because here's why, and this is why I made the decision. I was put in a position where I could have gone to New York and I could have done the Brady Bunch 8 shows a week for however long they were there and probably had a good time and lived in New York and that sort of stuff. And I think about that part and go, man, I should have done it just to go and live in New York for a while and have that experience. Or I could have stayed in Chicago and did what I did, which was start to understudy all the roles that were left by the people that went to New York. And now all of a sudden I'm doing 10 different shows a week, different styles of comedy, different directors, different casts, different roles, which I think made me a much better performer. Because I was forced to, you know, on any given night be doing a high status character, a low status character, a musical, a play, you know. So for personal growth, staying made me better at what I did. For relationships, I think it hurt my relationships with a lot of those people.
The other thing that I thought was interesting when I was around that time, too, is like I think youth had a lot to do with it, you know, and the success of the theater coming so quickly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and then also I think something that I was unaware of is I felt there was a lot of jealousy, you know, and certainly like I would be afraid to say, oh, I'm jealous of this person's success because we saw very quickly people getting hired from, you know, to Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it was that first sense of growing pains, I think. And we were all in our 20s. We're all in our 20s. And all of a sudden, I mean, for people who like don't know that history, like we started the theater in 89 and all this started to happen in, or no, we started, we did Splatter in 87. So we started Splatter in 87. Coed was in 89. And this is 1990. So 3 years later, all of a sudden you're doing a show and Quincy Jones is there and Lorne Michaels is there in our little theater watching people thinking, oh, we're going to take this person to New York. And I mean, in 3 years, we went from not even charging admission and having people pay as they left the show to I'm holding the door open as a limo pulls up and out comes Quincy Jones and Lorne Michaels. It was insane.
Right. And I know for me at that time, it's like, okay, if they can make it, I can make it. So then the entitlement comes in, you know, because certainly at that time and probably still to some degree, it's like, I'm going to be a big comedy star. Did you have those same feelings too?
Oh, sure. We all did. I remember when I first started in Chicago, I worked at Ed DeBevick's. And I remember sitting down with one of the managers when I first got interviewed at Ed DeBevick's. And they're like, well, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I said, oh, I'd probably be on a TV show. Like, and you know, and now here's, you know, it's, I don't know how many years, 30 years later, I'm still in Chicago, you know, just, and I think that part of the downside of being such a close group of people is that you all begin to see yourself as equals. because you're going through the same experiences, you have similar senses of humor, you're working on the same shows, you like each other, you're doing all those things. And then when some people separate themselves from that group, you're happy for them, but you're also like, why isn't that me?
Right. I always go to like, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you get over that? How did you get over that? Like, what am I doing wrong?
Well, I think it's something that I used to tell my students here is, you know, when I was actively teaching, on the last day of class, I would always just have kind of a Q&A with students. And something that it took me a long time to learn that I try to impart on them now is that so many of the things that happen to you in this business are completely out of your control, and they have absolutely nothing to do with how talented you are. People are going to make decisions on your career that affect you and affect other people around you that maybe have nothing to do with how talented you are. And if the only reason you're doing this is to get famous, you will probably spend most of your life bitter. But if you're doing it because you have something to say and you enjoy this avenue of saying it, you'll always find something cool to do and you'll always be creative and you'll always find an outlet.
Because I'm obsessed with the whole fame thing, and I certainly have had my bouts with bitterness, goes on and off. And we've been around and we've seen people go to huge heights.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, and this is just a theory I'm throwing out, do you think some of it has to do with drive? You know, like, let's go back to the annoyance. Like, we were all in the same pool for the mm-hmm. most part in terms of talent. We were doing multiple shows a week and we were getting better and better and better and better. But there's a point where it's drive. It's the drive that makes it, the desire, you know, yeah. not feeling like, you know, I don't care what somebody thinks, I'm going to do it. Do you feel that there's some truth to that?
Oh, I think so, for sure. And I think that and also the choices, it goes into the choices that you make, right? Like, you know, we're sitting in Second City right now. People ask me now, like, why didn't you ever audition for touring company? Why didn't you ever do that? And for me at the time, I was so focused on annoyance. And for me, what I knew of the touring company was, oh, if you get hired by touring company at Second City, you're going to travel around in a van and you're going to perform material that other people have written that you get to now perform. And you're going to do the same show over and over again. And so here I am as a young performer and I'm going, okay, I wasn't seeing the business part of it. So I look at that and go, that sounds okay. Or I can stay in this theater that I helped create and have carte blanche to do anything I want, create anything, come up with any idea, perform with anybody I want to. And for me at the time, that was more appealing. But now I look back at that and go, man, if I had been in touring company during that time, maybe I would have been in a touring company with Amy Sedaris or Steve Colbert or Steve Carell and built that relationship. And how might that have changed my life? But yeah, and I'll never know.
But, you know, and you toured around with Joe Bill doing Bass Prob, and you went to different cities and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I certainly have done that, too. And you see almost in some cities the same kind of dynamic that we had in the 90s, which was very territorial.
Yeah.
And it was – you certainly, I would agree, was the grudge keeper, the person that was most vocal about us against them kind of mentality.
Yeah.
But – as I hear you talking about that us against them mentality doesn't really serve the person in the long run.
It doesn't serve the person. It doesn't serve the institution. And it doesn't serve the community. It's, you know, I mean, if you just take our example, I remember a night at Annoyance where there was almost a physical fight between people from Annoyance at a party and Horatio Sanz and Neil Flynn and some other people from I.O., because they had come to one of our parties and we felt like they didn't belong. And there was a confrontation there. And I look back on that now and go, how stupid was that? Like, who cares? And years later, when the Del Close Marathon happened.
In New York.
In New York. UCB. Yeah, yeah. I remember being in that theater at about 4 a.m, sitting in the dark with Horatio Sanz, drinking Bloody Marys, and just laughing our asses off. And talking about those times, like, what were we thinking? Like, how cool would it have been if you know, that cross-pollination had happened more openly back in those days and what cool things may have come out of
it. What do you think the fear was?
I don't know. I think there was some territorial stuff, you know, like, because I think the biggest difference between Annoyance and IO back in that time and Second City was that, you know, Annoyance was a theater company. It was a group of people that, it was really kind of a repertory company. When you went to see a show, there was a group of people that you'd see them in almost every show and different roles and different responsibilities. But you were seeing like that troupe of actors do different things. Whereas IO, you were seeing a bunch of different people kind of segmented into their own Herald team. So I think there was a little bit of that, like, you guys aren't like us because we're a theater company and you're more a venue and that sort of thing. So maybe that was part of it. And again, we're all in our 20s and
But what's
stupid.
Interesting is that reputation of being the grudge keeper kind of follows you later when you show up to IO and people say to you, what are you doing here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were many times I walk into IO and people would be like, well, why are you here? I thought you hated this place.
And well, how did you feel about that?
You know, it was weird. But I never took it too seriously, and I had the chance to sit in with a great group called Georgia Pacific. And
how did that happen?
I think it happened because Joe was their director for a while, Joe Bill, and we had closed down the Annoyance in 2000, so I wasn't doing very much. And it's weird, you know, as a performer, when you kind of abruptly go from being on stage 10 times a week to being on stage zero times a week, you're just like, what's this thing called time? Like, what am I doing with myself? And they were in residence at IO every Sunday night. And it was people that I knew, TJ and Jack McBrayer, who Jack was in the touring company when I directed it at Second City, and Pat Shea and all those guys. And they're like, well, why don't you just come play with us? And I didn't even have much experience in a Herald, but they weren't really doing a real Herald. They were just kind of doing whatever. And so I said, sure, and started playing with them. And it was so much fun and kept doing that until they got taken off the schedule.
Which is pretty amazing because you didn't have to take classes to perform. Did you get any pushback from that?
No, I don't think anybody knew that. Right? And at that point, because I'd already been so established at Annoyance that I was just kind of like a guest.
They probably figured, oh, yeah, he took classes back in the
80s. Somewhere, yeah.
So what did change for you to be comfortable of just going over to the Annoyance and going, you know what, who cares?
Oh, to IO?
Yeah.
I think just over time you start to mellow in that way. And by that time, you know, by the time I started doing that more, those walls had kind of broken down. Mm-hmm. You know, people from IO had started getting hired at Second City, and Mick started directing at Second City, and I had been teaching at Second City by then. So all those little connections were starting to be made cross-culturally, and it wasn't even a big deal anymore.
And this is, I always find fascinating. You never took any formal improv class.
No. First improv class I was ever in, I was teaching it.
So I think it's interesting. If you could have gone back, you're in Chicago in the 80, late 80s, early 90s, who would you have wanted to study with, or what program would you have liked to have gone in?
Well, looking back at it, I think I would have liked to have done it all if there had been time. I remember, like, a big influence on me, even though I never had him as a teacher, was Martin DeMott. And the stuff that Martin... because Mick brought him in to consult sometimes at Annoyance and run exercises and things like that. When we were working on Splatter, Martin came in and ran us through some improv stuff. But like philosophically and the way he talked about like relationships and being together and being in moments and that sort of stuff, that's the stuff that I really ended up gravitating towards and has become part of my teaching and the way I like to perform.
Let's talk about some of your teaching, because when people hear the Annoyance, you know, because when I was there, Mick hadn't really even developed his method.
You were one of our first teachers.
Yes, yeah, I was. Yeah. And I was just teaching whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
But Mick hadn't written the book and worked with it. And so I, in a lot of ways, missed out on that. And one of the things is take care of yourself first. Hold on to your shit. And I think everyone who teaches in any sort of institution or something, they all have their different interpretations of that.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
For me, it means that the best support that you can give your scene partner is to be a definitive presence on stage. That's what it means to me.
Give me an example.
So often I see performers, especially when we teach on the road, and I know you teach on the road too, we see performers who are focused on the yes and mindset, yes and their partner to the point of not being themselves.
And giving away, sometimes they'll initiate a point of view or a strong character, and they will yes and themselves away.
Exactly.
That is so frustrating
yes,
to watch.
Yes, exactly. And for me, the way I interpret the annoyance mindset is, what is it that I present at the beginning of a scene that makes me unique and powerful? And how can I use that to interact with my scene partner and elevate both of us in this scene without giving away the thing that I've created?
Now, you also talk about in your teaching philosophy the importance of the couple seconds at the beginning of the scene. Can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. And the way I teach it in class is, and I think from what I hear, like there's elements of this that are aligned with things that Dell used to talk about, and that is that thing that you do in the beginning must somehow be important, or otherwise, why would you do it? If you are improvising and you can do anything you want, those choices that you make early that sometimes improvisers just kind of make to get the ball rolling and get them to the thing they really want to do, they don't give them the importance that they need to give them. And in fact, I believe that everything you need in the scene occurs in the first 15 seconds of the scene. If you're listening and you're paying attention to your scene partner and you're ready to build on those things, they're already there for you. You don't have to go searching.
So two people come out and they look at each other. All right, so I'm looking at mm-hmm. you right now and you're nodding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's all we need, right, to start?
Yeah, if we're listening to each other. And
what does that mean? Listening.
Mm-hmm.
So we're coming out there. I'm looking at you. You're nodding. Your eyes mm-hmm. are wide and stuff like that. What does it mean? Because there's no words being spoken right now. What does listening mean in this moment?
Yep. For me, it's how are you portraying your energy against how I am feeling in my energy? And how am I going to use that to either come together with you and match that energy and be kind of similar? Or how am I going to subtly play against it, either with my words or my mindset, even though we're presenting similar energy? So if the audience is watching us, they're seeing two guys that physically are very similar. So now we get to decide, are we going to be similar, or are we going to be different but look similar, or how are we going to play that dance?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fun part for me, is figuring that out with the person I'm up there with.
And so let's go back to it. We're looking at each other. I'm looking at you, mm-hmm. nodding. You've got your so you're very attentive. Mm-hmm. I feel right now that, you know, we could be in trouble, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You think so?
Mm-hmm. Or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Could be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back in there, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Cool.
Yeah, whatever you want. Yeah.
Okay.
That's cool. Yeah.
Okay. Kel?
Yeah?
Can I have the gun?
This gun?
Yeah.
You want me to give you the gun?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hi. That's a big ask.
Okay.
That's a big ask
okay.
well, for me. To just hand it over.
How am I gonna rob the bank without the gun?
Well, you're a creative person.
Okay.
I could give you the gun.
Would you?
It's like I could give you a fish.
Okay.
But then what?
That's
the
yeah,
it's the old proverb,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I give you a fish,
yeah.
You might rob a bank.
Right.
But
right.
if I show you.
You're trying to teach me something.
Exactly.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, I'm gonna write a note and I'm gonna say that you have a gun out here. That's what I'm gonna do.
Yeah,
what
try
you?
That.
Okay.
Try that. I believe in you.
Thank you.
That's the important thing.
Can you check my spelling?
That looks good. Thanks. A little bit formal.
Okay.
But you don't have to. I'm just for future reference.
Okay.
You don't have to be that formal.
Okay, great.
You can be right straightforward.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to put my mask on.
Oh, that's a nice mask.
Thanks, man.
Did you make that yourself?
Yeah.
I did not know.
Well, you said we needed a mask. So like two weeks ago, I started knitting.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's some really...
It's a monkey.
I could tell.
Yeah.
That's really nice stitching.
Okay, so that was... So what do we... So let's talk about that for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically just got it from each other's
mm-hmm.
energy.
Right. And just picking up on little movement and rhythm. You know, you don't need a suggestion. And you immediately, let me go back to that. Another big thing that I like to have people focus on is you said the first line,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think a lot of times in the annoyance teaching, people feel like they have to say something crazy with that first line because
right.
it's annoyance and I gotta, right. you know, I gotta shake the world or right. be dirty or crazy.
Right.
And one of the things that I like to remind people of is that if the second person responds with a point of view and power, it doesn't matter what the first line is. If I respond to you or you respond to me after I say that first line mm-hmm. in a way that makes it mean something, then it doesn't really matter what I say because you've immediately decided that it's going to mean something.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do that, it doesn't matter what I say because we're already in trouble.
So what you're saying is people put way too much pressure on themselves on that first line to be funny or outrageous or something.
Absolutely.
Like that, versus you're saying ease into it. Get mm-hmm. into the relationship. You're not, give yourself permission the first 10, 15 seconds not to get a laugh.
Oh, yeah. I don't even think about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think about how are we negotiating the rhythm mm-hmm. and stuff between us, right? And how are we establishing, for lack of a better term, what the song is, mm-hmm. right? So for us, the song was your uncertainty, those little fidgets, the little like hesitation, and me in my nodding and movement more certain.
Right.
So there's uncertainty and then there's certainty. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of confidence and then there's confidence.
Low status, so, high status.
Yep. And now we just do that dance and see where that takes us.
Right. And then if we slow down, we can find things like check my spelling and mm-hmm. the mask. We can go into those details. But if we're rushing, right. we're going to want to get to the bank robbery.
Exactly.
And that's usually pretty boring.
Right. Exactly.
The other thing you talk about, which I really like, and I think it's a really hard concept, I know when I'm teaching, and that is vulnerability. And I know I stress it, be vulnerable, be vulnerable, be vulnerable. But you almost have an exercise to get people to be more mm. vulnerable. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's it's done in sort of phases. And basically, I usually bring it out in a class situation about halfway through. So I kind of lay the groundwork around like some listening, how am I in relationship to the space, all those things, like reminding people some of that important stuff. And then on the day that we do that exercise, I come in and start with everything that we've talked about so far, forget it all. Don't think about it at all. The only thing I want you to think about tonight is what is happening to me right now and how does it make me feel? That's it. Your character is motivated only by what is happening in this moment and how does it make me feel? And then the first round of scenes all start with the phrase, I love you, because you can't blow that off.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to respond in some way to somebody saying to you, I love you. And people build through that. It slows them down. It makes them react. And it's interesting to see how when we're only focused on the now, how quickly we pick up on the subtleties, the small things, the little change in tone, and then we start to address that. Because I think that so often, like you just said, in improv scenes, we're so in a hurry to get to the next thing that we play scenes that are like this wide and an inch deep instead of this wide and 4 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes out of that exercise and what I focus the conversation on is when you go back and look at the scenes that people do, they're not really about that much, right? But they're about a lot in a small window. And I think that's where the fun of discovery is. That, to me, like, that's discovery. And I think that it's so often what happens to improvisers is they project results on their choices. I make a choice. I expect you to respond in a certain way, and you don't. And now I go, ugh, now what? As opposed to if I'm truly in the moment and I make a choice and just wait for you to truly react to it, and then I truly react to that, then we're always going to be fine because we're not getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, and I think a version of that, too, is you make a choice, and then I deny you, and then you go back in the improviser or rule part of your brain going, he denied me and whatever, and it's mm-hmm. like, well, it's too late.
Now you're in judgment.
Now you're in judgment, yeah. And you're fucked,
yeah.
You know? And that's a hard one for me to let go of, you know. And what do you do when something like that happens? Let's say we're doing a scene together. You initiate something. I deny you, and it's just like so blatant, you know. Like, you know, how's the dog? We don't have. What do you mean we don't have a dog? What do you do in something like that?
I try to continue that philosophy that I just talked about in the face of that denial. So, where's the dog? We don't have a dog.
We don't have a dog.
What?
We don't have a dog.
That dog I've been feeding is not ours?
Yeah, we don't have a house either.
I have spent $100 feeding that dog. It's not even ours?
Well, we don't even have food either.
I can't believe... What have I been feeding that dog?
Well, it hasn't been food. And there you have it, another great episode of Improv Nerds in the Can. I want to thank our guest, Mark Sutton, for being so candid and very passionate about improv and sharing his philosophies on improv. Even losing 10 minutes of it, I don't think anybody felt ripped off. And I hope to make up those 10 minutes to Mark. And when I do, I will ask him that question about why we called him Mark Howard Sutton. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. And a big thank you to Jesse Swanson at the Second City Training Center in Chicago for securing a space so we could do this interview in person. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and find out all the information about my award-winning classes, The Artist Glow Comedy, my workshops, my intensives. Also, it's a great place to sign up for my Improv Nerd newsletter. We are taking over social media, as you know, so follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. Go to Facebook and like our Improv Nerd fan page. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And we have this wonderful YouTube channel, so subscribe to that. And support us on our Patreon. That would really help. Support us on our Patreon. I would really appreciate that. We're also lucky to be part of feralaudio.com. Check out all the great podcasts on feralaudio.com. And of course, you. Thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, he's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.